From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science writer David Quammen has spent the last 6 years working on a book about pathogens that have crossed over from wild animals to human beings. It's a phenomenon called zoonosis. Ebola is a zoonosis. So is bubonic plague. So is AIDS and rabies and the hantavirus. About 60% of all human infectious diseases have crossed over or spilled over. Spillover is the name of his book. Quammen traveled around the world to trace the origins of these frightening microbes, and today in the program he's joining us to talk about his investigation. Quammen explores why strange new diseases emerge, where they come from, and what sort of nasty bug may come next. He also asks if we're bringing these afflictions upon ourselves. David Quammen today, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the science writer David Quammen is joining us. He's traveled around the world exploring the pathogens, the viruses, and the other microbes that cross over from animals to humans. It's a phenomenon called zoonosis. Ebola is a zoonosis. So is bubonic plague. So is SARS and rabies and Lyme disease and AIDS. And these are diseases that were once confined to wild animals, but somewhere along the line, something happened that made them spill over to human beings. And the question is why? And why is this spillover happening with more frequency, as it seems to be the case? Quammen says it's not something that's happening to us. These outbreaks, he says, could be the result of things that we're doing. His book is called Spillover: Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. David Quammen is the author of a number of other books, Song of the Dodo, Monster of God, among others. He's written articles for magazines like the National Geographic, Harper's, the Atlantic Monthly. His writing has earned him numerous awards, including 3 National Magazine Awards. He's joining us from member station WXPN in Philadelphia. And David Quammen, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Doug.
Well, I want to begin with an experience you had 12 years ago. This was in 2000. You were sitting at a campfire, you say, in Central Africa. This was near the Ovindo River. You were on assignment for National Geographic, and it was here where I guess you learned 2 of the men in this crew that you were with had been present when the Ebola virus struck the village. Tell that story, if you would.
Right, yeah. This was in a forest block in northeastern Gabon called the Minkebi block, and I was walking across it with a wonderfully deranged field biologist named Mike Fay, who was doing a transect across Central Africa. And we were sitting at this campfire one night with his forest crew that included a couple of fellows from a nearby village, a village that was famous in the medical literature because it had suffered an Ebola outbreak just about 3 or 4 years earlier. Dozens of people had died, and these two fellows started talking about it, what it had been like personally when Ebola struck their village. Friends and loved ones were dying from this horrific outbreak. They didn't know what it was. They didn't know it was caused by a virus at the time. One of the fellows was holding his niece in his arms when she died, and she bled on him. He didn't get sick. He was lucky. And they told me about these personal experiences. And then one of them said, you know, and there was a funny thing when this was happening. He didn't say funny. It was peculiar. It was weird, spooky. Nearby in the forest, we saw a pile of 13 dead gorillas, a pile of 13 dead gorillas near the Ebola-racked village. And he didn't know what I knew, which is that gorillas, as well as chimps, as well as humans, are susceptible to Ebola. Yeah. They also die from this disease. So when he said that, the phrase stuck in my mind, the image stuck in my mind. This was 12 years ago, but I've never gotten it out of my mind, of these 13 dead gorillas in some sort of a pile. And what they represented to me was the connectedness of our diseases and their diseases, our connectedness with other species, with wildlife, including some of our closest relatives, by way of the infections that we that we jointly suffer, the infections that we share.
So this was 12 years ago. You suddenly saw this connection now. But what did you do, David Quammen? You put it aside for a time? Because you didn't start really investigating or writing it until a few years after that.
That's right. I finished the assignment. I wrote three stories on that cross-Congo trek. They were called the Mega Transect stories. That's what this expedition was called, the Mega Transect. And then I turned to other things. I had a book about Darwin to write, and I did that. I was finishing a book about big predators, Monster of God. Yeah. I had other things on my plate. But I had already been interested in the subject of Ebola, and this experience made me more interested in it. I started thinking about the possibility of a book project. And then about 6 years later, National Geographic sent me out to write a story about zoonotic diseases. Mm. They knew I was interested, and so I did a piece, a story with a wonderful photographer named Lynn Johnson that ran in sometime in 2007, as I recall. And that was the starting point for active work toward a book on the subject. Mm. And so I began 2006, 2007, going back out into the field, talking to scientists, traveling the world, reading the scientific literature, interviewing people, and spillover is the result of that.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about some of the people you came upon along the way, and certainly a lot of the stories, because it's full of extraordinary stories. But let's lay some groundwork first. Zoonosis, let's talk about that. As I mentioned, AIDS is an example, and SARS and Ebola. Right. And this is just a way of explaining and there are a number of these different types of diseases. It's not just a virus. It's also bacteria and worms and
protists. There are a number of different kinds of pathogens that can spill over from animals into humans. You said viruses, bacteria, fungi, protozoans, worms, prions, which are the things that cause mad cow disease. And an animal infection spilling over into humans, a non-human animal infection spilling into humans, is what we call a zoonosis.
Yeah.
And if it causes disease, then it's a zoonotic disease. But it doesn't necessarily cause disease. Some of these viruses and other things can spill over into humans and be innocent, harmless passengers.
Hmm. I was surprised.
There's one called simian foamy virus. That's one of my favorites. It's because of this gruesome name. It spills over from macaques in Southeast Asia and gets into humans. But as far as we can tell so far, it doesn't cause symptoms. It doesn't cause any disease. It's just a signal of the fact that we have been in close contact with macaques, close enough to receive one of their viruses.
I was surprised that influenza is an example of zoonosis. In fact, you say all the human influences started with animals.
Right. All of the influenzas that we know, influenza A, it's a whole group of influenzas that cause human influenzas. They all have their ultimate origin in wild aquatic birds. The animals, by the way, that these pathogens live in, the scientists call those the reservoir hosts.
Right.
Those are the animal. The reservoir host is the animal in which a pathogen, a virus, or whatever lives inconspicuously, permanently, without causing symptoms. It's reached some sort of an accommodation with that species. And birds are the reservoir hosts for all of the influenzas that come to humans. They spill over from wild birds, get into domestic birds, chickens and ducks. Sometimes they pass through pigs and get genetically mixed with another strain of influenza, and then they get into humans and sometimes cause really devastating pandemics.
Mm. You talk about that when a virus or one of these pathogens crosses over, it's not rare, it's common. But it's also, I guess the question I had was, does that mean it's natural? That seems a strange word. Maybe that's not the right word. Is it an accident? It is an aberration when it happens, I suppose.
Well, it is. It's a critter moving out of its accustomed habitat into new habitat.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that's natural. And in a sense, that's unnatural.
Right.
You know, it's hard to draw boundaries of these things. There's disturbance is one of the phenomenon that recurs in the natural world all the time. So this is a form of disturbance. It's a form of crossing of boundaries, crossing of accustomed boundaries, but it's not necessarily unnatural. In the book, I make the analogy that predators are large creatures that eat their prey from outside, and pathogens are small creatures that eat their prey from inside. And for a pathogen to pass from its accustomed host into a new host is, in a sense, unnatural, but it's no more unnatural than a predator like a lion that customarily kills zebras and wildebeests killing and eating a human. Mm. It happens.
Yeah.
But it's a switch from what is the usual behavior of the species.
I want to talk about the Hendra virus, because this is where you really – it's the first story, in fact, I guess, in the book. And it sort of plays – I guess all of this plays out in 1994 in the northern part of Australia. And you say in the book it's not the, you know, the first of the scary new bugs. It wasn't the worst. It didn't seem like it was something to worry about. It was spooky. But it's a good place, you say, to kind of start to talk about this – as you put it, this new virulent reality. Talk about Hendra.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I start with Hendra because it's a very small disease.
Yeah.
It's sort of a boutique disease. It hasn't affected very many people, but it's emblematic of the way these things work. 1994, a horse gets sick at a stables in a suburb of Brisbane, Australia, known as Hendra. Mm. This horse had been pastured out in an open field and then got sick and was brought into the stables by the stable, the trainer. And the horse got worse and worse. Its face swelled up. It had trouble breathing. It had a fever, had bloody froth coming up its throat, out its nostrils. Eventually, the horse died. 2 weeks passed. The stable foreman and the veterinarian who worked on it didn't know what had happened. They thought, well, maybe the horse had been bit by a snake. Maybe it got some toxic fodder, been accidentally poisoned or something. But then other horses in the same stables started coming down with the same symptoms, dying, going down like dominoes. Something like 7 horses died in a 24-hour period. These 3 guys are trying to save these horses, the veterinarian, the trainer, and a stable foreman. They're reaching down the throats of these horses to try and clear their windpipes. Mm-hmm. This bloody froth is everywhere. The horses are getting worse. They're dying. And then the trainer gets sick. He goes into the hospital. The stable foreman gets sick. He goes home. He feels like he's got a really bad flu. A little more time passes. The trainer dies. Stable foreman slowly gets better. The doctors isolate a virus from the trainer. It's a new virus they've never seen before. They isolate the same virus from the horses, so now they realize this is an infectious disease. Mm-hmm. It passes through horses and into humans. They gave it the name Hendra after the name of the suburb, and then they went looking for the reservoir host. They didn't know where it had come from. They eventually discovered that same virus in fruit bats, in these large, the Australians call them flying foxes, these large fruit bats with 2 and 3 foot wingspans. And those are the reservoir hosts of what we now call Hendra virus. Then they had to try and solve the question of how it got from the fruit bats into the horses. And they recalled on testimony from the trainer before he had died that the original horse that got sick had been out in this pasture, not in the stables, this open pasture. And there were some trees out there, and the trees were fig trees, native fig trees, and bats used to come and roost in the trees. The bats would have eaten the figs, dropped fig pulp on the ground, dropped their excretions, dropped feces and urine onto the ground, onto the grass. The horse was pastured there, went to the tree to get a little bit of shade, ate the grass, and picked up the virus that way.
And I guess the thing that it's a great place to start, I think, because it raises all of the questions that come up in these circumstances. You know, where did this thing come from? You know, where had it been? And how did the virus emerge from, as you put it in the book, its secret refuge? And why here? And why now? I mean, because I think those are the crucial questions. Where does and we'll work through these, David Quammen, as we go. But those are the questions that really you're working through in the book.
Absolutely. Why here? Why now? Why this? Why us? Those are the questions that I work through in the book.
I hope this isn't too simple-minded a question, but what do these pathogens want? You know, do they want to feed? Do they want to reproduce themselves? You write about in the book that there's some question about, for example, whether a virus is in fact alive. You mentioned that in some ways we could look at them as predators. We could look at – like they're looking for prey.
Right. That's a really good and interesting question, Doug, and it's a question that I was asking the experts 6 years ago when I began this project, talking to virologists, including people who study the evolution of viruses, and asking them, what do these viruses want? What are they trying to do? What represents evolutionary success for them? Are they even subject to Darwinian evolution? And what I heard back from them changed the way I think about viruses. First of all, viruses don't want anything. They don't have purposes. Yeah. They're very simple kinds of microorganisms. So that you can't say, well, this is what the virus chose to do, or this – they don't even like to talk about these are the options the virus had. There are simply results. There are consequences. There are not purposes. But viruses are subject to Darwinian evolution by way of natural selection. So the viruses that are most fit to their circumstances are the ones that succeed best in replicating themselves, and they come to dominate the populations of virus that they are within. So it's the survival of the fittest among viruses. One of the ways they survive is by stumbling into hosts. Stumbling is a little bit anthropomorphic too, but they chance their way into hosts that either do or do not represent opportune environments in which to replicate themselves. And when Hendra virus fell out of a bat and happened its way into horses, it found by chance a host that was very hospitable. They now refer to hosts – they now refer to horses as the amplifier hosts of Hendra virus, because the virus reproduces really, really rampantly, abundantly in horses. And that's why it kills them so quickly. That's why it causes all these symptoms. It's just – multiplying much more quickly than it does, for instance, in the bats where it lives quietly. So it gets into the horses. It finds this wonderful environment. It fills the horses with virus and comes pouring out on their bloody froth. And then sometimes it gets into humans and kills humans. It's different in humans because, so far as we know, it has not been passed human to human. It's not transmissible among humans, whereas it's very transmissible among viruses. And we do not know of a single case in which the virus passed directly from bats into humans. It didn't even pass from bats into the people who take care of injured bats, the people who do the bat rescue work, and there are quite a few of them in Australia. Those people were examined in one study after Hendra was discovered, and I think they looked at 128 people who had been handling these giant fruit bats and taking care of them, and none of those people had antibodies to Hendra virus. So it's a peculiar, not necessarily a unique situation, but a peculiar situation in which it takes the intermediary, the amplifier host of horses, to make this virus a really dangerous problem for humans.
What's so disconcerting, I think, and complicated about the pathogens is that they can hide. I mean, they go dormant, at least as I understand it, David Quammen, for years at a time. And they don't – I guess we don't think they just vanish. They don't just go away. And then for whatever reason, they reemerge and they live somewhere. They're an inactive – you know, where do they go?
That's right.
What are they doing?
They disappear for years at a time. For instance, Ebola. Ebola spilled over, first time we know of, in 1976 in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Yeah. And then years pass. It turns up every few years, every 5 years. Sometimes it might go even longer. There have been two outbreaks in Africa this summer, one in Democratic Republic of Congo and one in Uganda. But where does it go in between outbreaks? Again, it's a very pertinent question. Where it goes is back into – or it stays within its reservoir host.
Yeah.
It lives in the forest, hiding, living inconspicuously within some creature that it's its reservoir. And with Ebola, despite the the notoriety, the infamy of that virus, we still do not know what is the reservoir host of Ebola. The scientists who work on this suspect that it's bats for them also, but it has never been found living in bats. There have been there's been circumstantial evidence. There have been some antibodies found in bats suggesting exposure at least to Ebola, but that doesn't qualify proof for having located the reservoir host. So it's one of the big mysteries that remains in this field. What's the reservoir host of Ebola?
We should mention, since you're talking about Ebola, and there's a whole section about this. I mean, you talk about meeting these people. You were intrigued by the stories they told about the people close to them who had died from Ebola. Mm-hmm. You didn't start asking questions right then, but eventually they started to open up, you say, and a chimp was found that was rotten, and they
right,
butchered it
yeah.
and they ate it. And you mentioned the 13 gorillas, of course. But I guess when you're talking about Ebola, there's some myths there that you kind of put aside. And there's a lot of myths associated with it related to the book Hot Zone, which I wanted you to mention, because the Ebola that's, of course, portrayed in the book is pretty gruesome. And it's gruesome anyway, the true part of it. But right. Richard Preston mm-hmm. made it really really
right, and I don't want to be too hard on Richard Preston.
Right.
I don't want to speak ill of a colleague, but when and I read The Hot Zone when it came out. Yeah. I read the two-part piece that ran in the New Yorker. I found it riveting. It was part of what got me fascinated with Ebola, and it attracted even some of the professionals who now work in this field. Read The Hot Zone at the time. I know one woman who read it as a teenager, and she became an Ebola researcher.
Wow!
Now she says, "Well, you know, some of the things in it aren't accurate, but it had galvanized her interest as a young woman." What the particular points that I think merit correcting that are in a lot of people's minds, and that come largely from The Hot Zone, are that this is an extraordinarily preternaturally bloody disease. That that people, the term is used, people bleed out when they're dying of Ebola, almost as though, you know, they're horrific images. You know, you get the image of a water balloon popping. Richard Preston talks about one case in which a person's organs essentially liquefied. Well, these are not the usual symptoms of Ebola. And if a person dissolved as a result of Ebola, the chances are, I would just guess, and the experts that I've talked to have guessed this too, that it's possible that a person could die of Ebola and sit in the tropical sun for a couple of days while a secondary bacterial infection went a long way toward dissolving the poor person's organs. Mm. But Ebola does not do that. The experts don't even call the disease Ebola hemorrhagic fever anymore. They've dropped that term because in many, if not most of the cases, it doesn't cause extraordinary bleeding. People don't bleed out through their eyeballs, et cetera. But I want to add to that, though, that it is really a horrible disease, and it
sure.
kills a large portion of the people that it infects. It's a nasty, miserable disease that causes tragedy in these African villages. But it's not quite as much as a Stephen King phenomenon as people have been led to believe.
Well, it made me wonder what kind of a challenge it was for you as a writer to convey this story. It's clearly there are dire elements of this, to be sure, but it's also packed with so much fear and so much myth, it seems, these kinds of stories. You know, we're really afraid of this stuff because we don't really understand it very well.
That's right. And I say near the end of the book, the purpose of this book is not to make you more worried, not to scare you. The purpose of the book is to make you more smart.
Yeah.
These are scary diseases, and it is a scary pattern, a scary phenomenon. But the more you know about it, the more you understand the dynamics of this process. You understand the limitations as well as the potentials of these spillovers and these outbreaks. And you can also see the amazing scientific work and the courageous public health work that's going on to contain these outbreaks, to prevent the next big pandemic from happening. So it's a I suppose it's a gruesome subject, and I suppose it's a gruesome, dramatic book in a lot of ways. But I hope that it's also an empowering a book, that it will make people reassured. It will even fascinate them. It will, in some ways, entertain them. It will show them some amazing heroic scientists out having some formidable scientific adventures. And there's a certain, I hope there's a certain encouragement, a certain elation in reading stories about this detective work by heroic scientists.
David Quammen is with us. His book is called Spillover, Animal Infections, the Next Human Pandemic. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us David Quammen. We're talking about his book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. David Quammen, talk about the people who are interested in these kinds of things. I mean, you write about, for example, laboratory virologists, who you describe as not the kinds of people who you would meet in a bar waving their arms and bragging about their work. But then you have the other, maybe a contrast to that, which are the virus hunters, which another type entirely. Talk about these people you met.
The field people, yes.
Yeah.
This is a very interesting group of people. I've been very impressed with them, and I've enjoyed spending time in the field with them. They're sort of a new guild of scientists with a combination of skills that we really haven't seen before. Some of them are trained first as veterinarians, and then they discover that they're interested in the health of wildlife, so they work on wildlife diseases. In some cases, then they get a PhD in ecology and possibly also a master's in public health, or at least some combination of maybe two of those three. So they're trained in animal diseases that become human diseases. They're trained in the world of zoonoses, how to detect them, how to understand them, how to solve the mysteries about them, and how to deal with them. There's a fellow that I spent time with on a rooftop in Bangladesh, John Epstein, who works for a group called EcoHealth Alliance. And he's characteristic of this new combination of skills. He's a veterinarian with the skills of a field biologist and the concerns of a public health officer.
The question you get at, one of the questions you get at in the book is, why is it that these pathogens make the jump? You know, why do they spill over? What are the factors that are making this happen? And what seems to be, I don't know if the clincher, but one of the crucial parts is the thing that makes the bug manifest itself, I guess, is when the ecosystem is disturbed. Because if I understand you right, when the ecosystem is healthy and there are lots of, there's a lot of biological diversity, the pathogen may just sit there in the host. But when the system is disturbed, then you say, shake a tree and things fall out. Is that right?
Right. Yes. Disturbance, disruption represent opportunities for these pathogens to pass from their accustomed host into humans. I can't remember whether I use these words in the book, but talking about it, I think of two words that are sort of the yin and yang of this process, disruption and connectivity.
Yeah.
And disruption is on the side of the role of humans in disturbing ecosystems, especially very diverse tropical ecosystems around the world, the equatorial forests in particular. There are a lot of different species living there, and humans have always been in some of those places, but at very, very low population levels and with relatively undisruptive life styles and technologies. But now, more than ever, we are cutting down those forests. We're cutting our way through the Amazon. We're cutting our way through the Congo and the other tropical forests. We're taking the timber. We're building timber camps and mines and settlements, villages, etc. We're killing and eating the wildlife. some cases we're taking the wildlife away, using monkeys for medical research. So we're causing all these kinds of disruption, bringing us into close contact with the many species that live there and the many kinds of virus that inhabit those species. So that represents the disruption that gives these pathogens an opportunity to get into humans. And then there's the connectivity. That's the fact that we live in a globalized world. Everybody is flying every which way very quickly. We're shipping products and wildlife, both living and dead, around the world. So when a virus does get into humans and manages to replicate there and succeeds in transmitting itself from one human to another, then its vistas are enormous. In some cases, it can travel around the world slowly. In some cases, it can travel around the world very quickly. The virus that became the pandemic strain of HIV, for instance, got into humans and has traveled around the world very slowly, but ultimately to devastating effect. A virus like the one that caused SARS spilling over in southern China in 2003 got around the world in a matter of just a couple of days. So it's disruption and connectivity that make this really an increasing problem.
So if you look at, say, the Hendra virus, we're talking about a virus that's been around in creatures in Australia for millions of years, I guess. Mm-hmm. People have been around interacting with animals for tens of thousands of years. And for all of that time, then nothing happens. And then something shifts. You write about this in the book. Horses arrive, 1788. Right. That's kind of the shift that things move now.
As far as we know, anyway, as far as we know, there are no records of Aboriginal people in Australia experiencing Hendra virus disease. If it happened, it hasn't been preserved in their oral history. They don't talk about it. Maybe it didn't happen at all. If it didn't happen, it's not because the bats weren't there, because the bats were there. It's almost certainly not because the virus wasn't there. As far as we can tell, the virus has been in the bats a long time. But the amplifier host wasn't there.
Yeah.
The horses weren't there. There were grass-eating animals. There were kangaroos and potoros and various kinds of indigenous marsupial wildlife, wombats and other things, wallabies. But those, as far as we can tell, don't happen to be susceptible to Hendra virus. Then in 1788, as you say, British settlers arrived and brought horses and changed the circumstances, changed the potential horizons for Hendra virus. Still, it took a long time before we noticed a Hendra virus outbreak. That's not to say they hadn't happened earlier. But finally in 1994, for probably a combination of reasons that included cutting down the native forests of the fruit bats and driving them to look for fruit and blossoms and nectar closer to human settlements, the balance had been changed and the fruit bats were coming closer to us and to our livestock, and eventually the virus spilled into horses.
You write this in the book. You say every spillover is like a sweepstakes ticket bought by the pathogen for the prize of a new and more grandiose existence.
Right. And for instance, the pandemic strain of HIV won that sweepstakes. I talk in my long section on HIV about the fact that there have been 12 spillovers of HIV viruses from non-human primates into humans that we know about. 12 spillovers of what's called simian immunodeficiency virus, the version of the virus that lives in chimps and in monkeys and in gorillas in some cases in Central Africa. 12 of those have occurred from primates, non-human primates into humans, and only one of those, the nefarious HIV-1 group M, accounts for virtually the whole AIDS pandemic. The 11 others have been much, much smaller and less consequential events. So it was HIV-1 group M that, in the darkest sense, won the sweepstakes of colonizing humans.
Well, you write about the scientists who traced that pandemic strain of HIV to one chimpanzee in Cameroon.
Right. They know now, based on very persuasive molecular phylogenetics work that's been done in the last 5 years by a couple of wonderful scientists, Beatrice Hahn, who was at Alabama, and Michael Warraby in Arizona, and their colleagues and teams. And Beatrice Hahn has essentially answered the question of where did the pandemic strain of HIV spill over? And the answer is that it spilled over in southeastern Cameroon, the southeastern corner of Cameroon in Central Africa. Michael Warraby addressed the question of when, and based on some very ingenious work and a little bit of good luck in terms of finding tissue samples that were HIV positive in the 1950s, he has ascertained that the original spillover must have occurred quite a bit earlier than we've thought until now, probably occurred before 1908, give or take a margin of error. So earlier than 1908, in the southeastern corner of Cameroon, this thing got into humans, and then it simmered for decades. That's a very different story from what we have thought we knew about the origins of AIDS.
No, very different. I mean, it and this idea of having, you know, this flight attendant who came to be known as Patient Zero, it changes the story entirely.
Right. Yeah. When Randy Schultz wrote a wonderful, important book, when the band played on.
Yeah.
He talked about this Canadian flight attendant, Gaetan Dugas, mm-hmm. who was a very active homosexual in the bathhouse scene of San Francisco and other cities in the late 70s, early 80s. And this fellow got the label Patient Zero because he had been the first among the first large identified cluster of AIDS cases to be identified. But Gaetan Dugas was not patient zero. He was patient, 471,366. The real patient zero was this hypothetical chimpanzee hunter in Cameroon in about 1908. And the scenario that is proposed to explain how that happened, this has to be inferential. It's the details are unknowable. But the scenario is called the cut hunter hypothesis. Mm. The scientists talk about that this presumably was a fellow who killed and butchered a chimpanzee and in the course of doing that probably cut himself and got blood-to-blood contact with the blood of an infected chimpanzee, and that's how it got into humans.
And there's the sweepstakes, right?
There's the sweepstakes. That virus got into that one human, and it managed to replicate in him, and it managed to be transmitted. Not transmitted very frequently or very broadly, but just enough to keep it alive for decades in Central Africa until it got to the city of Leopoldville, the capital of the Belgian Congo, and that seems to be where it encountered different sexual mores, different conditions in a couple of ways, and started really to multiply.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Gary is with us in Salt Lake. Gary, welcome.
Hi, Doug. My question goes kind of to the heart of you know, what we see in a lot of viruses, and that's, you know, they're just basic destructiveness, and it seems counterintuitive that these viruses would be so deadly, and rather you'd think that the advantage would be to be more benign but be able to spread, you know, more easily from host to host. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could kind of address why you think they are so destructive when it doesn't seem to be an advantage.
They seem suicidal or something.
That's a good question, Gary. There's a balance between their degree of destructiveness and their transmissibility and their success. The destruction is the scientific term is virulence. You know, a really virulent virus is one that kills its hosts relatively quickly, multiplies abundantly, kills it relatively quickly. And then there's the issue of transmission. We remember there's a familiar old phrase, you know, the first rule of a successful parasite is don't kill your host. Well, that's not really true.
Yeah.
The real rule that operates on any parasites like these viruses is don't kill your hosts if you're going to do it until you've had a chance to get yourself transmitted to another host.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't let the boat sink underneath you until you've gotten close enough to jump into another boat. But that still leaves the possibility of these viruses being very, very destructive, extremely virulent. Mm. For instance, Ebola is extremely virulent. It's not transmissible through the air, so it does tend to kill people pretty quickly, and Ebola outbreaks can be controlled. In some cases, they die out. In some cases, they're controlled by good public health measures and what they call barrier nursing, you know, rubber gloves and masks and things. When people stop having contact with the bodily fluids of infected Ebola patients, it cannot pass through the air, as I said. Mm. Then there are other viruses that are much more patient, kill people in most cases, but kill people very slowly. And the most obvious example of that is HIV. Mm. It kills people so slowly that it can be transmitted for a period of 10 years in some cases. And then there are the airborne viruses, yeah, like influenza and SARS that can pass on a sneeze or a cough and get into a human and then kill the person that they infected first. But in the meantime, they have managed to infect another person.
You know, it made me wonder, and thanks, Gary, very much, by the way, for the call. It did make me wonder, because you write a little bit about, I'm not sure if this is the way to describe it, but kind of the life cycle of an epidemic. And you write about, this is where you write about mathematics, and you confess that you're no mathematician, but talk about how math tells us about the life of an epidemic, you know, like when an epidemic ends.
Right.
Because that
right.
seems to be not entirely clear.
Well, it's not, but the mathematics of infectious disease has been developed over the last 100 years. I trace some of that, as you say. I admit to not being a mathematician, but I'm interested in the way scientists, particularly field biologists, ecologists, even virologists, use math to try and understand pandemics. So the thinking has developed over a long period of time, and there have been some famous scientific papers on the math of infectious disease. But if you were going to focus on just one aspect of that, it would be the number that they call R naught, capital R, and then a little zero after it, naught as in zero. And R naught is the measure, what they call it, the basic reproductive rate of a pathogen, of a disease organism. And what that means is the average number of cases that are caused by each individual case in a susceptible population. It's essentially the factor of multiplication, this basic reproductive rate. So if R naught is greater than 1.0, then you have a positive growth rate of the infection in the population. And if it's less than 1.0, then the disease tends to die out naturally. And we can see that, as it must have applied, for instance, to HIV in those very early years. What I was saying in English rather than in math was that for decades after it passed into that cut hunter in southeastern Cameroon, HIV 1 group M in humans must have had an R naught barely over 1.0. Just a little bit, just enough to keep it going. And then finally it got into the big cities, and it got into the Canadian airline steward, and it got into people who had very active sex lives with a lot of partners. And at that point, R naught started to be significantly more than 1.0. And, of course, injectable drugs and the other factors we know that are involved in the transmission of AIDS also raised R naught well above 1.0, transfusions, sharing needles and things like that. So once that parameter got well above 1.0 for the AIDS virus, then the pandemic was on its way.
David Quammen is with us. His book is called Spillover: Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with David Quammen. We're talking about his book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. I wanted to ask you, in the book, you raise the question of just what it is that makes a living thing experience an outbreak, and not just a microbe, but also, you know, an insect or a mammal. And you write about this entomologist named Alan Berryman, who has suggested that the most serious outbreak on the planet has been the species Homo sapiens, that we're an outbreak population.
That's right. Yeah. I get into that at the end of the book, trying to get a handle on how to think about this whole thing and what the future holds. Alan Berryman, as you say, calls humans an outbreak population. It's not a moral judgment. It's an ecological description.
Yeah.
An outbreak population is any population that tends to cycle from relatively low levels to extremely high levels and then back to relatively low levels. This is important for the ecologists who study forest insects, particularly forest Lepidoptera, moths especially. The moths that we know in the West, such as tussock moth, spruce budworm, and the tent caterpillars, a couple of species of tent caterpillars. They go through these cycles where suddenly there's an outbreak and you see tent caterpillars everywhere, or you see gypsy moths everywhere, and they have a devastating effect on forest, eating the leaves, eating the needles, mining their way through the tissues of the trees for a year or two, and maybe they kill some trees, or maybe they just eat the trees bare, and then they go from this state of incredible abundance to almost indetectable levels. They essentially disappear. And this was puzzling to the people who study those outbreak populations of insects until they discovered a group of viruses called nucleopolyhedrosis viruses. And they now realize that what causes the end of those outbreaks is infestations of these viruses that crash the populations by infecting the caterpillars. And so I talk about this at the end because people like Berryman have said, well, humans are an outbreak population. And there's justification for that because, after all, there's 7 billion of us on the planet. Never in the history of this planet has there been a single species of large-bodied vertebrate that was anything like that abundant. So it does make sense to think of us as an outbreak population. And then, of course, I raise the point that, well, one thing about outbreaks is they end.
Yeah.
And they frequently end because of viruses. So that's what I call the analogy. And the question then is whether that analogy is applicable to the human future. I can't predict the future. We don't know that it is, but it's a question, I think, that's worth very serious attention.
Well, and another big question, of course, is the question you put, can we reverse or at least mitigate some of these trends before we're hit with this devastating pandemic? And you write towards the end of the book about, you mentioned the tent caterpillars in a conversation you had with a man named Greg Dwyer, an ecologist at the University of Chicago. You were trying to get some insights on outbreaks. And I guess the takeaway from Greg Dwyer, David Quammen, was that a lot of this kind of depends. It depends on what we do, on our human behavior.
It depends. And Greg Dwyer has done a lot of mathematical modeling of these outbreaks. And one of the things he's found is that if there's a diversity of behavior in the caterpillars, he studies gypsy moths.
Yeah.
If there's what he calls heterogeneity of behavior, then the population is far less likely to crash as a result of infection by the virus. And I asked him about the analogy, and he thought about it very carefully, and he said, you know what, I think it is applicable, and I think part of what's applicable is that there is great diversity of behavior in humans, great potential for diverse behaviors, for learning, for caution, for change, for stopping what we're doing wrong and doing some things right. And he said, you know, the bottom line is that humans are more intelligent than tent caterpillars, and that possibly, that very simple, obvious thing, possibly is the important part of the mathematical equation that will describe what happens to us when the next big one hits.
About a minute left. Let me ask about your sense of what you've learned about the next big one. Any sense of it? You say in the book it could very well be the flu.
Yeah. I asked the experts. I can't really say anything that I haven't heard them say. And what I hear them saying is that they're very possibly, even likely, will be a next big pandemic. If it occurs, it will almost certainly be a zoonotic disease. It will come to us from an animal. It will almost certainly be a virus. And the chances are it will be a single-stranded RNA virus, particular kinds of virus. Different viral families fall into the category of single-stranded RNA, including the influenzas and the SARS virus. Why RNA? Because when they replicate, they make more mistakes. There are more mutations, and they therefore adapt more quickly than DNA double helix viruses do.
Are you worried?
Am I worried? I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But I also detail in the book all the fabulously smart, sophisticated science that's being done out there to try and detect these things, and all the work that's being done in laboratories to try and cope with them. I'm very impressed by the scientists who are working on this, and I suppose that's what allows me to sleep at night.
Yeah. David Quammen, his book is Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. He joined us today from member station WXPN in Philadelphia. David Quammen, thanks very much.
Doug, very good to talk with you about this. I appreciate the conversation.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.